Hi, and welcome to another Canny Conversations podcast powered by the Pathway Group. My name's Mark Wakeley, and I'm one of the team who bring you these podcasts each week. In this particular series, Safraz Ali will be talking to some of the business people he's met and worked with in his 23 years at the heart of the West Midlands business community. And of course, many of the businesses that are part of the Multicultural Apprenticeship Alliance. In this particular episode, we return to Safraz's conversation with Charlotte Bosworth, the Managing Director of Innovate Awards. They return to the subject of skills development, education, and workforce evolution. Charlotte emphasises the importance of adapting to employment needs, broadening support beyond formal qualifications, plus enhancing workforce recruitment and upskilling. They also touch on sector trends, challenges in endpoint assessment, and the need for stability in the education system. Charlotte shares insights into her book writing experience, international market exploration, and involvement in school governance. She finishes with a message of hope and collaboration for a strong, more effective education and skills landscape. So let's rejoin their conversation.
Take every opportunity, and it allowed my career to continue to grow. And I ended up going into OCR, RSA as it was then, as an administrator on a twilight shift to being the director of vocational education.
So from a fairly young age, you're managing people, managing teams,
yes,
progressing in terms of becoming a senior manager and then sort of operations director and so forth. Talk to us a little bit about the transition in terms of your leadership skills, and obviously you're sponging and you're learning as you go. You're going on to these courses as well, but the people around you and how you've developed as a leader, Charlotte, if you can.
So I think when I initially started managing people, I tried to replicate other people's styles, and I'm sure many people have fallen into that trap, but realized a couple of years in, actually, where I got the most out of people is if I was myself, and they did look to me to make the decisions, and they did look to me to be the person who was empowering them, moving them forward, moving the business forward, but actually replicating the styles of others just wasn't the approach. So I think that whole kind of lived experience by starting down in the ranks and growing through a business actually really, really helped me, particularly at my time as OCR, because I always had management responsibility, but in different areas, different departments. So I could live and breathe and feel what it was like for ultimately the people that were doing the hard work on the ground. And I've never wanted to lose that lived experience. And I quite often say to my team, when I meet somebody new and they come to our organization, is we're not a hierarchical organization until things go wrong. And then actually, when things go wrong, that's where we do become a hierarchical organization, because it's on me. And that seems to have been an approach that works for us. We do a Be Heard survey. I don't know whether that's something you're aware of, where we measure a number of different factors around satisfaction of our people. And that's currently at 98% across the board. Okay. So people are happy. And I sometimes pinch myself and ask how I've done that. I think, Saf, the other thing is really important, and it's the reason I sit on things such as the ALP board, actually, is there's other leaders around the table who have different styles, but you can still learn and pick the things that you think are going to help you to continue to grow as a leader. I don't think you can ever stop learning, you can never stop growing, and you're always still going to make mistakes, which is the same with any role in any organization. And it's more around how you kind of recover from that and get better and recognize and sometimes go, I got that wrong.
Charlotte, you mentioned two names, one from school and one from a workplace. Obviously, these individuals have had a significant impact on your sort of development and you as a person. If you talk about, in terms of people, mentors and so forth, I mean, presently now, and, mm-hmm. and people who've been maybe in terms of your role as an MD, it's a lonely place, it's quite difficult. You know, you talked about earlier on, you know, the fact that you're supporting others. Who's there for you in terms of that network and support? Or who do you lean on? You know, you've got many, many different hats on, many different organizations. How do you keep yourself on the sort of straight and narrow? And because it's a tough world out there.
Yeah. So one of the early mentors I had where my career started really, really growing, and I was being asked to do public speaking, which actually is the thing I dislike the most.
Oh, really?
Is I went to a lady called Maggie Gallias.
Okay.
And Maggie, she's retired now.
Okay.
And she was the principal of Leicester College. She, okay. prior to that, was the principal of Henley College, okay. in Coventry, which is, yeah. where my connection came in, was principal of Leicester College, but also chair of the Learning Work Institute, has been president of the Association of Colleges. And whenever I saw her on a platform, I was just so in awe of this individual, and a bit back to, if you don't ask, you don't get. Yeah. So I approached her and said, I could really do with a mentor. I need to learn to speak on platform, be more confident, just even know what the hell to do. And she was a mentor for me around the public speaking piece, but continues to be a trusted friend and support to me. And I think then there's the people that, you know, I still meet day to day. And I don't know whether this is a good thing or bad thing, but I've found that I have been more drawn to the female leaders in the sector. Okay. And I don't know whether that's because there is less of, okay. us, that, yeah. it's easier to get a group of, yeah. people together and share challenges, whether that be how we manage our own organisations,
yeah.
through to some of the situations happening, yeah. in our sector. Yeah. But I found everybody in the main does want to help each other. We do want to support, yeah. each other. Mm. It's just finding the people that you're most comfortable with to do that.
Your advice is that ask if you
feel, yeah. Like, yeah. be a sponge, absorb everything, yeah. from everybody.
Okay. So in terms of some of these, I mean, you're going to go to modern day at the moment in terms of the multiple roles that you've got on. And I know it changes and evolves, and some of these opportunities are sort of more sort of 2-year cycles or 3-year cycles, and you do your bit and, you know, you make the impact and you're happy to sort of move on, and others you get involved with because they need your support. So from my,
and also it's good for other people to have an opportunity, yeah, as well, again, and it's good to see new talent, absolutely. Come through as well.
So Walsall College, you know, you've been there for a little while, you're a governor, you're a vice chair, you're part of Walsall College for what seems like a fairly long period,
yeah.
when you talk about sort of governors, and you're also, on top of that, you've also recently been appointed as the chair for FAB, Federation of Awarding Bodies. So that's two big, significant sort of trustee type roles there. In addition to that, you've got the role with ELP, the Association of Employment Learning Providers as well. So three big, heavy hitting roles, as well as being obviously, you know, the full-time day job, as well as all the other stuff that you do. So talk to us a little bit about each one of those. So let's take Walsall College as the starting point. So Walsall College, your role, your vice chair, you've been vice chair for a number of years now. Started off as a governor. Colleges have gone through a lot of transition, yeah. you know, a lot of changes happened. Again, a lot of responsibility on your shoulder in terms of governance, a lot of responsibility in terms of that support as well. Walsall College has gone through a massive amount of change as well. So what can you share with us in terms of that experience?
It feels like it is the one thing that keeps me truly grounded. And Walsall isn't Coventry and Coventry isn't Walsall, but there, mm-hmm. is a number of shared challenges that they both have. Quite recently, we're at Walsall College, we're due for an inspection.
Okay.
And we were having some governor training on inspections, and the lady who was providing the training, she said, okay, I'm going to ask you one question. Yeah. How would you respond if we say, how are you looking after your students and what they know about Gaza?
Okay.
And my response at that moment was, well, no, I'm actually more bothered about how we keep them safe. And they're more bothered about how we keep them safe from the train station to the college.
Oh.
So I can understand that you're thinking about these wider things. And just knowing, you know what, there's young people now at the moment who are just worried day to day. and they're in Walsall Town Centre. You know, that there's a gang culture there that's becoming more and more of an issue.
Cost of living, all of these issues.
Cost of living. Yeah. But actually, when you get beyond that, there are a lot of young people, not dissimilar to myself, as I see that young Charlotte, who do want to learn. They do want to find a way out. They do want to have a career and they do want to progress. They just need somebody to believe in them and help them to achieve that. And I've been lucky enough that I've met many, many young people at the college that I've seen grow, develop, and become absolutely fantastic characters and individuals. So the college has my heart is the fairest way to say it.
And you're actively involved as a governor, as a vice chair. It's a big responsibility as well.
People will see me carrying out all my other meetings based at the Walsall College, particularly in the atrium, which is really, really good. And they've got a little Costa coffee there, which is highly recommended if anybody wants to visit.
So FAB, Federation of Awarding Bodies, and this is again the collective responsibility. You know, you are a figurehead within the sector, the voice for endpoint assessment organisations, awarding organisations. So talk to us a little bit about FAB and the what that as an entity does, and you know, your input and your role.
So I've sat on the Federation of Awarding Bodies board for a while, and my original driver of getting involved in the board is I'd been at a big awarding organisation which had its whole own policy team, lots of people to do your influence and lobbying for you, and then suddenly I come to Innovate, which is a much smaller team, and realise that you actually need to rely on these other organisations to support that lobbying policy side of it. And it was either that I paid £45,000-£50,000 to bring in my own policy expert, or do I actually utilise a membership organisation? And if I'm going to utilise a membership organisation, I want to be around the table, so they're influencing things that are important to my business. So that was my original driver for getting on the board. What I've realised since then is actually it's not just about your own positioning, it's about the whole sector. And I've managed to get to a point where I think I can have a balanced view, but an influential one. And it's how I best use that for the best of the sector. So I could have continued doing it on the board, but the chairs wanted to step down. So I feel I've built those relationships with government officials, and also have gained the respect of my fellow endpoint assessment organisations and awarding organisations. And they believe I can do a good job. So I really want to give it a go. I'm not officially in post until the 8th of April. Monday, actually.
So we'll
see how that goes. But, you know, anything I can do, particularly as we go into the next few months, which is going to protect, support, and allow our sector to do what it does best, is where I want to be, what I want to position on.
Not only do you have the voice in terms of when you're, you know, running your own organisation, but now you've got that collective responsibility, the true collective responsibility, being part of this association, but also ELP as well. So the Association of Employment Learning Providers as well, which again, another sort of collective membership organisation. So talk to us a little bit about the role that you have with ELP. I mean, it's a long, you know, you've been...
I think it applies to both the FAD one and the ALP one to a certain extent. Is you as one person can't have a voice. It's what the whole makeup of that whole board is. So from the Federation of Awarding Bodies, we're actually bringing in some new board members where we believe we're not fully representative. So we've recently done a skills audit, and we can see we need more of that international expertise as a number of businesses grow there. And when we look at ALP, that is where my role in ALP is we've got lots of business leaders, particularly of training providers and of colleges, but it had a gap in relation to that assessment awarding background. And that's the part I play on the outboard, is bringing that level of expertise. So if there's any consultation that's required, and ALP have a number of EPAOs in their own right who are our members. So I run a number of special interest groups, write thought pieces, and support research on that side as well. So that really is the role I play. So it's not duplicating what the others do, but complementing by bringing that assessment expertise in.
So Charlotte, when you're talking to, say, government ministers and various other sort of outside the stakeholders on a sort of a national level and so forth, you know, we've got Ofqual, you've got all those sort of different push and pull factors going on. What are the sort of conversations? I mean, how easy is it to get the message across? I mean, you're often at the chalk face, at the coal face of what's going on. You've got a sense of really what, you know, things that need changing. And a lot of the time it's about getting the message across to say, this doesn't seem to be working, this could work better. How receptive are the powers that be, the ministers, all the other people, that the civil servants, all the other people that really make up the piece?
I think a lot of the time civil servants are just as frustrated as we are, but can't necessarily say that. And, you know, sometimes we know that policy decisions are made that are the wrong ones, but once that decision is made, it's sometimes difficult to unravel. What I found, particularly in recent times, and, you know, this is very, very well documented, is a lot of conversation revolves around there's not enough money in the system. Now, the reality is they can't change that. So it's thinking more creatively of actually what else do we need to do that can make the system more effective and efficient. And this might sound that I'm doing myself out of a job, actually, with what I'm about to say next. So there's been a lot of criticism quite recently around the cost of endpoint assessment, the amount of time it takes for people to be in endpoint assessment, and having the right capacity when it comes to assessors. So from a government department, you could just say, well, that's not working, let's scrap it. But actually, there's other ways where we can improve that and make that work. So part of it is actually that solutionizing without throwing the baby out with the bathwater to a certain extent. And I just think we know that there's not going to be more money in the system, but actually, how can we continue to have quality teaching and learning, but make other parts of the system, endpoint assessment, more efficient and more workable?
I think there's been a theme in the last sort of every sort of conference, whether it's an ELP conference or an AAC or any of those sort of big conferences, when everybody gets together, that they feel that, you know, there's been, particularly with endpoint assessments, that the government's been too slow, or it's not been ready, or it's not really listened and so forth. And the infrastructure in terms of the vision and the infrastructure don't seem to match, or sometimes there's a lack of vision, or the intention's there, but the implementation isn't working. So what's your general sort of thoughts and outlook on this?
I think what we end up with is policymakers will have an idea, they'll be asked to do something by a minister, and they'll go off and come up with what they believe the solution is without actually having the right people in the room to help them get to that, aka the people that are going to be on the ground developing, delivering and making this work. So it comes back to that collaboration and building a trusted system where it's felt they can come to individuals and have those conversations and recognize none of us are trying to catch them out. We all want to make it as work as much as they do, but tell us what the problem is you're trying to deal with so we can help find the solutions for you. And we still need to work more on those trusted, open conversations, where I feel quite often things get shrouded in mystery and saying, okay, what really, really is the problem? Be honest with us. Say there is no more money in the system, so stop asking for more money. But what we need to do is make sure more people are passing and the system is working more efficiently. If people were honest and said that, then we could certainly, as an industry, work with them to improve those areas that they're trying to tackle.
Charlotte, if you had a wish list in terms of some of the changes and so forth, I mean, one of your thought pieces I've seen before is that, you know, you're looking to possibly get the language changed from, say, endpoint assessment to endpoint examination. And language does matter. It does matter. I think it just gives the right impression of what we're trying to achieve. Previously, you've also said that there's a lot of people who were in terms of endpoint assessments that book them, but then, you know, they reschedule or they cancel and so forth. There's a lot of that going on as well, a lot of inconsistencies. So in terms of some of the changes, particularly in terms of the sector and so forth, are there any quick wins, do you feel, or is there any suggestions or ideas?
Well, I can mention the ones that have been well documented, such as functional skills and off the job, you know, and they've been mentioned many, many times. But actually, there's some more simplistic things that we could do. But I just think by just changing one thing in isolation, there's a number of things with the program delivery, program structure, and endpoint assessment, where if collectively we made subtle changes, it could have quite a big impact.
Okay. So it's not necessarily a big bang, small improvement, small
exactly. Yeah, and you know what, I think there's something around where we have to be honest around which occupations are most suited to an apprenticeship being the way of measuring it, and which ones might sit outside of that. Not all.
No one size fits all.
Exactly. Thing, yeah. You know, and we need to be honest about that. Now that brings challenges when we've got employers who are paying a tax. And at the moment, that is determined around apprenticeships. So apprenticeships is going to be the go-to. Yeah. But we've certainly seen it. I'm going to pull out logistics as a perfect example. If you think about people working in Amazon, Whistle, that's very seasonal, peak periods. And actually, it's all about productivity and utilization. Saying that the person then has to go off and do a day's training a week. Yeah. It's just not going to work for their business model. So actually, how can there be something different that still recognises there are individuals who have that opportunity to be developed, but an apprenticeship can't necessarily always be the catch-all.
So, Charlotte, in terms of sort of messages, like you touched on it earlier on, potential change in government, we don't know. It's a fair chance. What's your sort of messages and thoughts in terms of potentially new government, new ministers are changing recently. Any sort of ideas, any thoughts, any sort of words of encouragement? Are we hopeful? Are we, you know, is there much change do you feel, do you envisage?
So I'm going to possibly go more broadly than apprenticeships and talk about skills and education. I mentioned GCSEs earlier and that they've been around since 1988. And actually, they're seen as really successful as much as A-levels are. In the first years, they weren't. You know, actually, there was a lot of kind of tweaking, moving things around to make that work in the way people expected in the early days. But what we tend to do when it comes to skills is we give things 2-3 years. And if it isn't exactly how we think it should be, it's a whole reform rather than just a redefinition and tweak to it. So what we actually need across our skills system is we just need to stabilize everything.
Okay.
Let's stop throwing everything out. Let's just stabilize it. Let's see where we need to just
we don't need
change
to, we
things
don't need
a
to restart
but
again,
we
yeah.
don't need to suddenly say okay yeah, I don't know whether you people this, yeah. we had the diploma that didn't even hit the desks of young people sit in it, and then we were like, let's get rid of that. We bring in T levels.
Yeah.
We're now on about ABS.
Yeah.
Actually, stop.
Yeah.
We need some stabilization so we can actually really properly figure out what's working or not. I ideally would like to take education out of the political agenda and along with how it sat above, so we could come up with a proper 30-year plan.
Okay.
Wouldn't that be great?
30-year plan, okay. So
even a 10-year one would be
even
great.
Even a 10-year plan you'll take, yeah. So, you know, one of our conversations previously was something about the Baker Award, and you had your views and on that. So talk to us a little bit about some of the changes, some of the things that you feel as a country, as a nation, because, you know, education, you know how important it is. It's been part of your development, giving you the opportunity, social mobility. It's the only way out of poverty to a certain level, humble beginnings and so forth. It's the number one reason people are able to sort of move and progress with their life. And education is really everything. It's about careers. And it's not really about the qualification as such. It's about careers really and so forth. So talk to us a little bit about some of your thoughts in terms of getting people ready really for life. And
well, it's fascinating, isn't it? We think of a child and they go off to nursery and they go to their first school, primary school, and everything there is they're learning English, math, science all together. That, you know, nothing is separated out. Then they move on to secondary education, and then we decide to segment everything down, and people will go off and have their English, maths, science, geography, whatever it may be. And now that is all academic subjects. It's all academic subjects. And then we suddenly expect them to be able to bring that all back together, contextualize it, and just crack on and be okay in a workplace. who is helping with that transition? Who is helping people bring all that back together? So I've got a big question around, actually, should we be breaking down things into subject areas? Or actually, should everything have a level of contextualized learning? At the very, very least, and I think that's going a step too far for any government, but we should be making sure people from a young age are supported about what this world of work is going to be. And we just do not do that. And there are a number of initiatives which have taken place where at the age of 14, that starts. And gosh, I don't know what you were doing at 14, but I kind of started getting that myself because I was working in a hardware shop on a Saturday. So I started that transition myself, but that can't really help. That doesn't really work now for various reasons. So what should we be doing at a much younger age? And I would say year 9 to start supporting young people with what work looks like and that transition into work and actually making sure that that is built into the curriculum. And we could call it soft skills, we could call it employability, but I think that needs to start happening and people need to get a real sense of what work looks like. And even more so now, as we hear, I was talking to a young person, 15, and I asked them what, if they had any idea. I know I didn't have any idea at 15 what I wanted my career to be. But the answer was, I want to be a dental nurse or an influencer. And it's fascinating that we've now got a different world where actually who's saying, oh, you could be an influencer, but actually this is what that really means. And these are all the skills you really need to do that. This isn't just about dancing around on TikTok.
Yeah.
and you know, I just think there's a lot more we need to do to support young people around actually what work really means, whatever that career is you wish it to be, even if it isn't any traditional job roles.
Sean, one of the other hats that you do wear is, again, from the many list of other things that you do, is you're a trustee of a school as well.
Yes.
So some of the challenges of schools, I mean, it's not easy being a head of a school, particularly in terms of managing schools or part of the leadership of schools. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of sort of variables there, a lot of pressure there. So you know, talk to us a little bit about some of those sort of challenges as well, you know, because you see it, you know, at that sort of first-hand level, really being a trustee, a governor.
This was an interesting project, which, again, I didn't know how to say no to.
Yeah.
So there's an employer, actually. It's a textile company, clothing line, called David Nieper, particularly big in Europe. Yeah. And they had a school that was based next to their factory, which was the second worst failing school in the whole of Derbyshire. And they could see that it was having a real, real problem on them getting their future talent and their future workforce because of the place it was based, a place called Alfreton in Derbyshire. So the CEO had this idea that wouldn't it be great if a number of employers took over the school and actually made the school better. And that's how I ended up getting involved to support with the curriculum, what actually that should look like, how we make sure that those employability skills were built into the way the school worked and operated, as well as growing that academic achievement. That school is now oversubscribed. It has been oversubscribed for a few years, and we're now a grade 2 Ofsted, and we're very, very proud that our GCSE and A-level results are higher than the national average. And, you know, some real, real simple things that allowed to get that school to that, making people feel proud of where they went. People had never had a uniform before, but actually the employers invested in uniforms for young people. Suddenly they found they had an identity, actually, because of the area it was based in, that made a massive difference. People didn't feel they were being judged by their clothing because everyone was the same. Had a real, real impact. And then just that, having employers come in, people talk about different careers, actually giving somebody the opportunity to go to their workplace. We have people such as Bowman & Kirkland, Denby, then the David Nieper business as well, JCB, all been involved and actually just showing it's what you believe in yourself and where you want to get to that's going to allow you to get there. And that's given the young people in the school the drive to do better and actually now proud to attend the school. And the majority have gone on to fantastic careers.
One of the things I sort of touched on again, looking through your sort of profile and some of the things that you've been involved with, is that, you know, you've had a big role in curriculum development and designing curriculum and understanding the impact of the curriculum has on learning as a whole. And, you know, we're now in the phase where, you know, AI, artificial intelligence is a big part of our life. You know, awarding bodies are speaking about it, education institutions, as well as the workplace and how that's affecting that. So, you know, if you're able to share some thoughts in terms of some of the changes that are happening, particularly in terms of curriculum design, keeping fit for purpose, qualifications that are more useful as well, yeah, in terms of making impact and making the difference, because we're all about making that difference, not qualification for the sake of it. So just generally around your views on that.
So a number of things. Whether we like it or not, AI is here to stay, and it's something that clearly we have to be aware of some of the pitfalls. And I say that as an examination board where, you know, plagiarism could go, yeah, through the absolute roof. But actually the positives that we can take from it, you know, it's here to stay. We're actually working with a third party to develop a AI qualification at the moment, mm-hmm, to support businesses with how they actually maximize the use of it and how they upskill their workforce to utilize it. But I just think quite often we get scared of technology, we get scared of change, where we should be saying, actually, look at the opportunities this creates. Now, I certainly don't want to be saying, okay, my development team, you'll no longer have a purpose. But if anything can give them a helping hand to ensure that a curriculum development isn't going to take 9 months and it can actually be done in 9 days, surely that's a positive. We still need human intervention to make sure that's right, appropriate, fit for purpose, particularly for the audience we're trying to serve. But why wouldn't we embrace that technology and use that helping hand if it's there for us?
During my research, I came across the fact that you wrote a book a few years ago, and it was a very interesting title. I mean, published by Cogan Page, and it was talking about developing employability and enterprise and coaching strategies for success in the workplace. It was a few years ago. You're co-author of that. How things have changed, and talk to us a little bit about that. You know, once you write a book, it's a bit of a habit to a certain level. It might take you another 15 years to write the next one, but talk to us a little bit about the whole book itself, the learning aspect of it. You know, have things changed, and any plans possibly for probably another publication or another book, or any updates on just
yeah,
that?
So my enjoyment of writing always tended to be what I'd call pleasure writing. So no facts behind it, just whatever was in my head. And I'd come up with some fiction that I thought would look great. And I actually, I used to dance. So I used to write songs quite a lot, which would never, ever sell. So that is certainly not in me. So actually turning that to write something that was factual was a whole different experience. And again, it's pulling on your own experiences that you've had, looking at research, spending the time to kind of really think about why would somebody pay 20 quid to read this, and why would they pick it up and feel they're going to learn something from me? And maybe that's a bit of an imposter syndrome, I don't know. But it was just an amazing experience, just questioning myself, and do I actually really know anything, or don't I? But once I got into it, I kind of cracked on, and I realised I have to write in block.
Yeah.
I can't just go away and do it. So I can kind of see how these amazing writers need to go off and spend months by the sea to write. But yeah, it was a fantastic experience. And one thing that's recently come tonight is the book has now been translated into Korean.
Oh, right, okay.
And on the back of it, I've been asked if I can go out and speak to the Korean government around employability. Wow. So that'll be interesting. And also been asked by my co-author if I'll also be involved in a few chapters of a new book. Also, so we'll wait to see how that progresses.
So the book has been translated to the Korean language, and
yes,
the Korean government has then picked it up and said, you know what, we want to talk to you because you talk a bit of sense here.
Yes. So I've actually even seen my name in Korean which is fascinating. Wow. Maybe I need to learn to do my signature that way.
Is it,
yeah, in the past couple of weeks.
Wow. So it just shows how things change and exactly, you know what the opportunities are. Just being,
but I think, you know, there is, when we think about employability, although technology comes in, things evolve, there's still a lot of that basic stuff that applies. We need to be able to communicate well. We need to appreciate each other. There needs to be humility. That stuff.
So some of those things, you know, whether you call it soft skills or whatever the case is,
exactly.
those are long-standing sort of skills that
exactly.
are still tried and tested and so
exactly.
forth. So Charlotte, in terms of, you know, you talk about some certain things have changed, certain things haven't changed, you know, the GCCs haven't changed and so forth. And again, you put a fantastic case on that. Look, but we've had also a lot of changes as well. Look, quite a few elements. We're probably navigating through another season of some change happening. So talk to us a little bit about, and I'm trying to bring this podcast to a little bit of a close in terms of future, you know, horizon, really, in terms of what, you know, what do you see in terms of your organization? What do you see in terms of the sector as a whole? And something in terms of the landscape, really, as a nation, particularly with regard to education, work, you know, anything you want to share with us?
Yeah, so I think as a business, what I've realized we are good at is that interpretation of what an employer requires. And how do we then, as a business, evolve to support that whole life cycle? So, you know, we've spoke about, we're very well known for our place in the apprenticeship sector, but actually it's how we broaden that to be different and how we support that retention, recruitment and upskill of not just our own workforce as we need to evolve, but actually the employers we work with. And recognizing everything shouldn't just be about formal qualifications. There are other things that we need to offer, need to be available if we're really, really going to help those L&D departments, HR departments, early years, careers, teams to actually say, how do we recruit, retain and upskill our workforce? And that is going to have to continue. But I believe because money is tighter for businesses as well, we need to find the most efficient, best way of doing that. And I think we can only do that by actually embedding ourselves more in those organizations. So for us, it's very much that evolvement of not just seeing ourselves as an endpoint assessment organization, but an organization that can assess and support the growth of individuals, particularly with certain employers.
In terms of future aspirations for yourselves, I mean, you've had a fantastic run with regard to massive sort of scale-up growth, not just in terms of revenue, but also in terms of obviously the staff which comes in there, but also the qualification range, the number of employers you're working with and the business dynamics. What's the trends in terms of going forward? What's the ambition? I mean, I know it's not about the numbers, but it's about the impact and so forth. But just give us an idea of, you know, what the trajectory looks like for yourselves.
So we've certainly made real inroads into getting into the creative sector.
Yeah.
So that's become a real growth area for us. We've recently got into the transport and logistics sector. So again, we're seeing huge growth there. I've mentioned not everything being formal qualifications. This is an area where we're seeing particular combined authorities having a massive interest in that, along with employers who want to recognise that they've got high quality programmes they are delivering, but don't necessarily need that to be a formal qualification because they don't want that constraint. And then lastly is, at the moment, we are exploring the international market and to see whether what we do is something that we should offer internationally. And that's been driven by some of the employers we work with who aren't just UK-based, but are global, and the interest of actually working outside the UK there.
It is a smaller world out there. And if, as you said, there's a number of employers who are multinational and you know, want possibly the consistency across the globe, really, in terms
exactly
of their offer as well. So, Charlotte, obviously it's been fantastic. I mean, it's been an eye-opener for me, particularly in terms of the research. And yes, I've seen you on stage and I've heard, you know, you talk about the sector and give us all a pep talk. And, you know, particularly when we're feeling a little bit gloomy and so forth, and you've always cheered us up and given us hope as well. And today, you know, there's been a slightly different dimension. I've got to know a little bit about yourself, a lot about yourself, really, that I wasn't aware of until I started doing the research as well. So it's been inspirational for myself as well. It's been very, very much quite cathartic in terms of listening to yourself and seeing the journey and you being open about sharing the journey that you've had. We've got nothing but respect for you. And as you said earlier on, the sector as a whole does look up to you and sees you as a peer, sees you as a leader. You are a thought leader. You are an influencer. There's no doubt. And I said right at the beginning, I do regard you as a mentor. So I've got nothing but respect for yourself and I salute you for your support. If I can request you to say some last few words of hope for us all and encouragement, Charlotte, and from my bottom of my heart, thank you.
We are in it together. And we are stronger together and, you know, we should never lose that hope. And that isn't just a bubbly personality in TWE. And I often say, whether it be to my team or others, the only gift we have is being able to change the things we can change. So let's not fixate on the things we can't. And hopefully then that makes us stronger together and gives us that hope that we all hang on to.
Charlotte, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, absolute pleasure to share some time with you and thank you once again. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Saf.
And that's where we're going to have to leave Safraz and Charlotte. We'd like to thank Charlotte for sharing her time and insight. If you're new to the podcast, let me tell you there are already 89 other Canny Conversations episodes out there. And you can listen to all those past episodes by searching for Canny Conversations on your preferred podcast platform or go to 1386audio.com/have a listen. We'd also love it if you could review, subscribe or follow the podcast and please tell your friends and colleagues about us. If you'd like to know more, then go to cannyconversationspodcast.co.uk or go to Safraz's website, safraz.co.uk. Safraz has also written a series of easy-to-follow business books, Canny Bites. These are available from cannybites.co.uk/buy-the-book. We'll be back soon with some more from Safraz Ali and his Canny Conversations. So until then, have a good week.
This is a 1386 audio production.